This is Herman Cain, and you are listening to FTR Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Stein, and you're listening to Matt Lewis and the News.
It's time for Matt Lewis and the News with senior contributor at the Daily Caller, Matt Lewis, featuring interviews with today's top newsmakers. And now, here's Matt.
All right, happy to have with us today Sam Leith. He is the author of Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Sam Leith, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So there's a lot of interesting definitions and kind of highbrow rhetoric stuff in the book that I like. But I think maybe the easiest way to talk about it is to talk about some of the figures, the people or I guess in this case, spirits that you talk about. So one of the champions of rhetoric is Satan, the original silver-tongued devil. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think I wanted to go back and in a sort of semi-facetious way, but show or get to one of the nubs of the feelings people have had about rhetoric over the years. There's one of the objections that goes back right to the beginning of rhetoric, goes back to Plato, is the idea that people who are good at using persuasive language, people who are good at oratory, can hoodwink you, you know, can sell you the used car that's going to turn out to be a lemon, or can talk you into trading your immortal soul for a mess of pottage. And so, you know, Satan is a kind of very good, you know, way of looking at that, because he's a fine, you know, what did he do? He talked Eve into eating the apple, you know. He is the tempter. He's the great persuader. You know, he seeks to persuade Jesus when he's tempting him in the desert. And conveniently, you know, Satan's, you know, the greatest literary representation of Satan is by Milton in Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. And in there, you know, Milton was a guy who was from a generation which learned formal rhetoric, you know, which is basically the subject of my book, as part of their school curriculum. You know, he was a grammar school boy. So he, you know, you're able to look at the way Milton Satan speaks, and it's quite a good sort of good study for what I'm trying to talk about.
Another is Cicero. If you would talk a little bit about Cicero, one of your champions of rhetoric and the attack dog of Roman forum.
Yeah, well, Cicero is not only one of the greatest theorists in the history of rhetoric. I mean, he wrote a couple of books which talk about how you make yourself persuasive, how you give a speech, how you put these things together. But he was also an absolutely superb practitioner. He was a lawyer. He was a politician in ancient Rome. And he was noted, you know, he was famous actually for the extraordinary skill with invective, you know, which is attacking rhetoric, which is, you know, he'd rain down insults on his enemies, such as, you know, hasn't been seen since until South Park came along pretty much. and Cicero, you know, he was really a pivotal figure, actually, because he saw off this guy Catiline, who was this sort of creepy aristocrat who was plotting a revolution. And Cicero denounced him, you know, in the Senate. And Catiline was basically just put to flight. I mean, Cicero rattled him. He's, you know, he said, "We know exactly what you're up to. You need to go into exile now." And Catiline fled, and then was, you know, defeated in battle, and the, you know, Rome was safe. Subsequently, of course, Cicero met with a very sticky end because he fell out with Mark Antony, who had him killed and his head cut off, and his severed head brought to Mark Antony where he was having dinner, and Mark Antony's wife Fulvia pulled out the hairpins out of her hair and stuck them through Cicero's tongue. You know, as a demonstration, this, you know, this tongue was this dangerous thing. You know, rhetoric, just what Cicero said, Cicero's words were dangerous.
That's a rough way to go.
It's a rough way to go. It just goes to show, you know, you can't be too clever.
That is right. Abe Lincoln, obviously revered here in the States, but you have him down as a great rhetorician, if that's the right way of saying it. Why is Abe Lincoln a good speaker?
Well, he's a good, I mean, he actually, the fact that he turned up as, you know, we think of him as the person who gave the Gettysburg Address. Actually, it wasn't. The official Gettysburg Address at the dedication of that cemetery was given by a guy now practically forgotten except as students of American history called Edward Everett, who spoke for something like 2.5 hours. He had to have a special like little boys' room tent right next door to the stage so that he could
go. Is this true?
He got off the stage. Yeah, absolutely true. He had prostate trouble. He spoke for 2.5 hours, and he was desperate by the end. That was probably what stopped him going on for 4.5 hours. But Lincoln was just there to give what was billed as a few appropriate remarks, you know, about fourth or fifth on the bill. And he delivered a speech that was 250-odd words long and that has survived in history ever since. And as well as being, you know, short and direct and in the plain style, you know, Everett was this great orator and classical orator. You know, Abe just came and spoke dead straight, but with such dignity and poise and actually with such sort of subtle skill. I mean, that speech in Gary Wills's excellent book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, he talks about it being, by possibly coincidence, possibly not, a perfect Periclean funeral oration. You know, he changed the course of history with that speech. So, yeah, I think he's pretty good.
Now, you have one chapter that has a combination of great speakers, Hitler and Churchill. And it is interesting that these two men who obviously we would say one is great and one is evil, but they were both great speakers. And it is interesting that both should arrive on the scene at the same time. And I would say very fortuitous that Churchill was there at the time to sort of respond to Hitler. But if you would talk about that.
Yeah, well, there were sort of two things going on with that chapter itself, two of my purposes, one of which was to obviously reiterate this point I make with Satan, that, you know, unfortunately, being very good at persuading people isn't necessarily a guarantee that you're a good person. You know, rhetorical skill, you know, can have some very, very, very bad consequences indeed, because, you know, Hitler talked his way into the German chancellorship, and, you know, look where it got Europe in the middle of the 20th century. But also to sound a note of kind of hope, which is, you know, bad men who are persuasive speakers can come along, but good men who are persuasive speakers, you know, are the antidote. And Churchill and Hitler were the sort of, you know, antitheses of each other in some ways, but, you know, they were fighting rhetoric with rhetoric. And obviously, you know, guns and bombs with guns and bombs, but, you know, the course of the war was shaped by Churchill's defiant, impressive, morale-raising rhetoric. But what's interesting, I think, I mean, you talked about the timing, is actually Churchill is a fine instance of how timing can help, because he'd been delivering these very bombastic speeches throughout his political career, and people kind of laughed at him for a long time. You know, he was always the guy who was more or less standing on the corner with the sandwich board, claiming that Western civilization was about to come to an end. And everyone was like, yeah, calm down, Winston, you're just in love with the sound of your own voice. But then it happened to be on his watch that Western civilization looked like it actually was going to come to an end. And that's the point at which suddenly, you know, he no longer looks like a windbag, he starts to look like a visionary. This is an illustration of an ancient rhetorical truth of something called kairos, the ancients called it, which means timeliness. You know, when you're speaking is really important, as well as what you're saying.
MLK, Martin Luther King, talk about him as a daydream believer. Why was Martin Luther King, what was it about him that made him such a great speaker?
Well, as with, I think, you know, all of the speakers we're talking about, you know, when you make a speech, you're kind of trying to find a form of words, you're trying to find a vocabulary, you're trying to find a sort of whole language that's going to help you to connect with your audience, to kind of make them feel that you're one of them, to wire them into something bigger, to kind of, if you like, draw authority from previous generations. You know, Churchill's speeches were very Elizabethan, you know, that at a time when Britain was under threat, suddenly he was unconsciously talking about the past, and, you know, his language recalled a period when Britain was standing firm against invasion by sea and all that. Likewise, you know, Martin Luther King wired his rhetoric into the kind of, it came out as the sort of black gospel churches of the South, as the civil rights movement did. And he produced a kind of electric political rhetoric out of that religious rhetoric. So, you know, his power as a speaker is the power of somebody sermonizing. And he talked about trying to form, you know, I mean, he had a sort of theological underpinning to his political project. He wanted to talk about creating a beloved community. It's sort of shaping, you know, black and white America into a kind of, into a congregation, if you like. And, you know, if you look at the way his speeches work, he has these great rolling, incantatory, sort of improvisational, semi-improvisational riffs that run through it. And he sounds like, you know, he sounds like the Bible some of the time. He channels bits of the Bible. And so he's got a huge sort of, you know, there's a huge mythic backdrop when he's speaking. You really do feel that, as he did, that he's somebody at this one point in history with the whole of a kind of history of Christian providential revelation coming behind him. And that can be quite persuasive if you're speaking to the right people.
And you talk about, you're moving forward, as we have chronologically, you talk about Ronald Reagan and some of the Peggy Noonan speeches, the Normandy speech, the Challenger speech.
These are the boys of Pointe du Hoc, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great line.
Oh, that makes the hairs stand up on the back of my neck even now. And that was the speech, as I'm sure most of your listeners will know, where he was commemorating the anniversary of the Rangers, the U.S. Rangers, fighting their way up this particularly kind of brutal cliff with German machine gun emplacements at the top of it. And he was making a speech at that pace at the top of the cliff. And there was a sort of memorial there, but some of the veterans of that campaign, you know, who were by then old men, were there sitting, you know, opposite him in the audience. And he had this extraordinary ability in that speech to sort of collapse, you know, he used the fact that they were there on that very spot to kind of collapse past and present. And he used what in classical terms is called enagia, which is, you know, painting a word picture. And he painted this hugely effective description of how, you know, 40 years ago today, I think it was 40 years, mm-hmm. he said, you know, the air was rent with gunfire, there's smoke, and he described the Texas Rangers fighting their way up these cliffs, you know, pulling themselves up and falling back, and pulling themselves up and falling back, and finally getting to the top and achieving it. And he then suddenly, you know, you were sort of transported into the past. And then he turns around and he says, you know, these are the boys of Pointe du Hoc. You know, these are the men. And he says, these are the boys of Pointe du Hoc. These are the men who conquered these cliffs. These are the champions who freed a continent. These are the heroes who helped win a war. I think that's the more or less the sequence. And so you suddenly got this thing, again, that sense of being in history. You know, he's addressing them now. These are the boys, because they were boys, and now they're old men. And you see it kind of going out from just boys and just these cliffs, Pointe du Hoc.
And I think maybe an old man.
It's in history.
An old man could get away with that, too. I wonder if Reagan had been 45 years old and he called these old men, these are the boys. It might not have worked, but because of the context, I think that might have helped them.
Yeah, it might have been tricky. I think given the lead up, it didn't look impertinent because it was clear. But it was, I mean, what was effective in that as well, I think, is there's a kind of intimacy to that. You know, and a lot of the most effective orators, and Lincoln was one as well, you know, will do that thing of, you speak in a great run of the high style and you're talking about champions and heroes and war and the movements of history. And then you kind of lean down and you say something intimate. You talk about, you know, folks, or you know, these are the boys, you know, and right. Suddenly they're these individual guys and you're remembering them when they were young and you're personalizing it. Because a lot of what's effective. You could see that also in Obama's speech on election night, where he anchored this great speech about American history and destiny and choice and, you know, the future, to this one woman, Ann Nixon Taylor, you know, who had cast her vote this time, but who first, you know, who had, I think, been born, you know, at the very beginning of the 20th century. And so he used her story as exemplary. And so that business of kind of anchoring big movements and grand things to the small and the intimate human scale is always hugely effective in rhetoric.
Yeah. And there's something that in that D-Day speech that Reagan gave, that one of my favorite parts, and no one ever quotes this, but he says, "Someday, Liz, I'll go back," said Private First Class Peter Robert Zanaga of the 37th Engineer Combat Battalion. "I'll go back and I'll see it again. I'll see the beach, the barricades, and the graves." And he's reading this letter. And wow, it's just so inspiring. And that's a part that I think really hits home. I don't know why, for some reason, that part, I guess it's certainly not as poetic as some of the other stuff, but I always felt that really connected.
I think that's exactly it. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's the human scale. And actually, in a much less high flown way, you see politicians doing it all the time when they campaign. They always, you know, like Joe the Plumber, they always say, you know, they never say unemployment is such and such a percentage and such, you know, they don't talk about percentages and big figures. You know, when they want to really get the message through, they say, you know, as I was in Iowa the other week and I was talking to this guy, you know, and his name was Dave Smith, and Dave works in a little mum pop shop, and, you know, federal taxes have hit him so hard, and, you know, and they always try and personalize it. They try and bring a big social issue or a big economic issue or a big political issue, or as Reagan did, a big historical issue, down to the human scale, because that's about getting your audience to identify.
True. But I guess my question to you is, I feel like in recent years, politicians have gotten much better at talking folksy language, and maybe there's something good about that. But if you think of, you know, Reagan's speech, like the Challenger disaster speech, you know, talks about slipping the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God. He talks about Sir Francis Drake. If you think back to RFK's speech on Martin Luther King's assassination, he quotes Aeschylus. I mean, is there something missing nowadays in the sense that everything has become so folksy? Like, was there something special about politics being a little bit elevated?
I think there's something to that. What I'd say probably cynically is that politics and the real sort of basic lesson of what I took out of studying rhetoric for this book is that it's always about finding the right form of words to connect with an audience. And so you find whatever will do the job. You just find the right tools. And an audience, you know, in the past might have been better able to connect with Aeschylus, or, you know, that highfalutin language has come to be something we mistrust and maybe is not, you know, it's not so widely understood. So the folksiness is finding the lowest common denominator. I think people would, if Obama were to say, start quoting Aeschylus, he'd become vulnerable, because, you know, his Republican opponents would instantly sail in and say, here is this hoity-toity right. elitist guy who spends his time, you know, talking to his fancy schmancy Harvard Washington Beltway friends about ancient Greeks, and we know where the Greeks led, you know, look at the, you know, default in the euro. You know, Mitt Romney has attacked Obama for talking in front of Greek columns and having European ideas. So I think quoting an ancient Greek poet wouldn't get you anywhere at the moment. You know, you need to talk about hockey mums now, but maybe in an era probably when... I mean, actually, maybe it's cause for optimism, because if politicians are speaking to a like-minded elite who will all know the Aeschylus reference, they'll talk about Aeschylus. If they feel really answerable to a huge number of people who will never have heard of Aeschylus, you can be sure they'll talk about hockey mums.
Right.
So it's a sign maybe of the
I think you should do is play against type. I mean, if I were advising Obama because of the vulnerabilities that you brought up, I would tell him to tone the rhetoric down. But maybe it would have been good if Palin had sort of ironically, if she injected some of this more sophisticated rhetoric into her speeches, maybe that would actually work and you know, without losing her base, maybe appeal to some others.
Well, that's the great skill. And I think it depends what you're trying to do. I wouldn't have thought, you know, I mean, Palin would have had trouble because of her politics and all of other things, reaching out, if you like, away from her base to the sort of, you know, coastal liberal intelligentsia that maybe, you know, lap up Obama's hive style. But that is the skill, is trying to find a form of words which doesn't alienate your base but makes converts. I mean, I think what you say about Obama is absolutely right. And again, illustrating this idea of kairos or timeliness. In 2008, Obama's obvious intelligence, obvious calm, obvious kind of, you know, self-confidence and lucidity was an advantage to him because, you know, we'd had this president for a long time, you'd had this president for a long time, who wasn't very articulate and whose folksiness had been attractive and had won him elections. But, you know, by the end of the Bush years, there was a sense of muddle and anger and confusion, and there were these unpopular wars. And Obama suddenly looked like this guy who was going to be able to sort it all out and was, you know, saying calming things about hope and the future. And that made him sound great. But now that's starting to look like a disadvantage because the, you know, the basic political rhetoric in the States, you know, the rhetorical weather is being made by talk radio and the Tea Party and by a kind of, you know, Main Street's hurting. Obama as the great hope monger, you know, didn't deliver entirely on his promises. And so, you know, instead of sounding calm and in control and, you know, like this intelligent guy's got solutions, the very same rhetorical style starts to sound, you know, detached, professorial, elite, you know, ivory tower. And I think that, you know, oddly enough, he could speak exactly the same way now as he did in 2008, and it would have helped him then and hurt him now.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. It's all context. And, you know, they always say elections are a reaction or an overreaction to the last president.
Yeah, and Mitt Romney is a very good instance. He's in the situation, actually, that Obama was in 2008. You know, he's campaigning against an incumbent. He's saying, I mean, he doesn't say, yes, we can, but he says, you know, a new America begins tomorrow. Or I think that's or something like it, if only it were more memorable. But, you know, he's the guy talking about the future and change. And Obama is in the situation of, you know, this unattractive campaigning subtext, which is, can you give me another four more years? I'll really get it right this time.
Well, speaking of Obama's, you know, rhetorical devices, you know, I noticed. See, you have a whole glossary in the back of your book, which is awesome. I mean, it's worth
I'm very nerdy. I love that those funny technical terms, but I can see that some people won't.
Oh, it's great! It's worth the price of the book just for this glossary of, you know, of anargia? I don't even know.
I pronounce it anargia, but I've never heard it said out loud, so maybe it's
needed. I know. As a writer, I have that happen to me all the time, that there are words that I like know how to spell, but I never got around to figuring out how to pronounce them. It's quite dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
But I wanted to ask you, because to me, as an observer, I see Obama doing certain things. Like, he has this sort of fake stutter that he will employ. Romney actually has one, too. And it's I'm not sure why stuttering is appealing, but
I think it's appealing. I mean, there are various rhetorical terms. I'm now trying to think what I can't off the top of my head remember which one it is, but hesitation or the attempt. I mean, it makes it look like you're thinking on your feet. You know, it makes it look like you're thinking hard about what you're saying and you're being cautious and you're not just sounding off. And that's, you know, anything that makes you look like you're actually being honest, and, you know, if you look like you're really thinking as you give the speech, that will make it look like you're honest, because you think, oh, he hasn't prepared some flim-flam. he's actually conscientiously trying to say what he thinks and thinking hard about it. It, you know, that has an effect of making you sound honest. And it's why, weirdly, you know, as I've been discussing, you know, Obama's high style being possibly disadvantageous to him, George W. Bush's inarticulacy didn't do him nearly as much harm as, you know, the liberals would have liked. Because actually, you know, like Forrest Gump, if you seem to be artless, if you seem to, you know, not be calculating and you know, foxy and too clever by half, people think you're honest. They'll think, you know, he's struggling to get the sentence out. How could he possibly be deceiving us?
You know, that is why, interesting.
That's why, for instance, you know, the silver-tongued devil, you know, people, right. People mistrust someone who's too smooth. People mistrust the smooth-talking used car salesman. You know, they like the guy who seems to be, you know, maybe not too bright, but obviously honest and thinks hard about what he's doing. So, yeah, hesitation makes you look less slick.
So that's one of, to me, I think there is this fake stutter, and who knows, maybe I have one too, I don't know, but I think Obama and Romney both have it. Now I'm being conscious of how I talk. but another thing I see Obama do is, you know, he's famous for having these straw men that he destroys. But if you would, you know, if you were to watch a typical Obama speech, what are a couple of the rhetorical devices that you as a trained professional observe him doing that the average person maybe doesn't pick up on? And while you're at it, if there's a fancy name for it, we can learn something.
Well, I mean, I think the straw manning is something that a lot of politicians do, and that falls under the realm. Aristotle said there are three ways you persuade people. One of them is ethos, which is basically your personal standing, how you present yourself, you know, as a person, you know, what they think of you, whether they trust you. Then there's pathos, which is trying to move the emotions. And then kind of in third place, there's logos, which is the actual ostensible subject of your argument and the structure of your argument, you know, logically also. But what Aristotle said, and this applies to all this straw manning stuff, is, you know, logos doesn't work like logic. You know, it's not A, therefore B, therefore C in a kind of mathematical syllogism way. It's kind of fuzzy. When you make deductions, you're talking about probabilities. You're talking about, you know, hidden assumptions. And hidden assumptions are a very good way of, so, you know, you, rather than arguing against what your opponent actually says, you present a straw man of what it looks like he says. And you say, you know, and actually the Republicans do it to Obama as well. I mean, that shameful thing when they said Obamacare was going to institute death panels. And they all said, well, you know, death panels, we must all be against them, surely. He was like, yeah, so am I. And Mitt Romney did a very good instance of straw manning. Not a straw manning, but it was a false opposition. He said, you know, I want to see a president who stands up for American workers and against union bosses. You're like, well, unionized workers might think that union bosses were on their side. But, you know, it's a good way of dividing a, you know, presenting what appears to be a real opposition or a binary choice. You know, you're with us or you're against us. You know, how about neither? So that, in logos, is what happens all the time. You know, you present A or B when the answer is C. In terms of his style, Obama is completely addicted to what we technical rhetoricians call anaphora, which actually politicians always, always, always do, which is where you repeat a phrase or word at the beginning of a sentence. So you build up a whole rhythm where he's, you know, he says, I'm going to be a president who does this. I'm going to be a president who does that. I'm going to be a president who does the third thing. But he's also, I mean, he builds very, very musical sentences. So he never says something, you know, in one term when he can say it in two, and that's called synthetone. He always goes, you know, we're talking about homes and jobs, people and places, fish and chips, you know, so that kind of
he does do that. That sounds
phallic
like
sounding thing.
What's that called again?
That's called synthetone, is where you say something and something, you know, and often there'll be synonyms more or less. And he also does, which again, I wish I knew why this was so effective, if there's some neurological explanation, I don't know. But the group of three, which is called the tricolon, technically. But, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, actually a misquote from Churchill, but
It's a sign of how effective tricolons are that we remember it that
way. Toil? You missed. It's a toil.
Yes, right? It was actually blood, sweat, toil, and tears. But it's always misremembered as blood, sweat, and tears, which is a sign that the human brain wants things to go into groups of three for some reason. And it's hugely rhetorically effective to do groups of three. And Obama does it all the time. I'm trying to think what I haven't got any of the speeches in front of me at the moment, but yeah, if you just look for groupings of three phrases that kind of rise up in kind of import and significance as you get to the end. So things fall into groups of three, they fall into balanced pairs. This synthetan thing does a lot of parallelisms, a lot of antitheses, you know, one thing and then the other. And the other thing he does, he's very conscious actually of, which we haven't touched on yet, of the noise that, you know, the rhythms and cadences of speech are really important. And I think, you know, one of the things that hasn't been much discussed about Yes, We Can is that actually the reason it sounds so forceful and determined and the reason it, you know, held such resonance to people is that it's a metrical object called a molossus, which is three stressed syllables in a row. And that's quite rare in speech, you know. Yes, we can. Thump, thump, thump. And, you know, those forms of words, you know, a molossus does sound solid, you know. You know, I like Ike was as well. And it's, you know, again, to throw something into the mix, this idea of euphony, you know, it's not necessarily entirely a coincidence that the first line, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, is a perfectly cadenced iambic pentameter. You know, it sticks in the brain because it has a sort of poetic rhythm. I mean, God, you don't write speeches in poetry, but being aware of how they sound is very helpful.
I love this stuff. Fascinating. And you can learn more if you get the book, Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Sam Leith, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Matt, thank you very much indeed.
You have been listening to Matt Lewis and the News with Daily Caller senior contributor Matt Lewis. You can email Matt at mlewis@mattlewis.org or find him on Twitter @MattKLewis.